are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Folks, for over 70 years, Littleton has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Just visit littletoncoin.com/majority. That's littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history, Elizabeth Hinton, author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Also on the program today, Trump announces that you can't know about his new Afghan policy. Meanwhile, the Interior Department stops a study on the health risks of mountaintop removal, and the Trump administration planning a new immigration push. Meanwhile, Jeff Flake hoping that Donald Trump gets lost on the way to Arizona tonight. And Marcellus Williams, man set to be executed tonight by the state of Missouri, despite new evidence, new DNA evidence that came from a court order search for new DNA evidence. And the former talk show host and nominee to be the chief scientist of the Department of Agriculture, he's got an MBA, folks, says homosexuality a choice and marriage equality could lead to pedophilia. And lastly, Steve Mnuchin's wife shuts down her Instagram account a day too late.
Yeah, okay.
All that and more on today's program, folks. All right, so last night, I don't know how many people tuned in for Donald Trump's attempt to change the subject to Afghanistan, and they apparently have spent just a tremendous amount of time interrogating this question of what to do in Afghanistan, and they have come up with an answer. And mostly that answer is something that you cannot know, ladies and gentlemen. There is, basically last night, he announced a secret plan that he could not tell you about. But one thing that he has done, which is a which will go down as completely not unique in the annals of not just the wars that we've been involved in, but this war, and as well as Iraq. Here is Donald Trump claiming he has stumbled upon a new perspective on when to end this war.
This war, we will learn from history. As a result of our comprehensive review, American strategy in Afghanistan and South Asia will change dramatically in the following ways. A core pillar of our new strategy is a shift from a time-based approach to one based on conditions. I've said it many times, how counterproductive it is for the United States to announce in advance the dates we intend to begin or end military options.
Okay, so let's just be clear here. This is a revolutionary new thing that he's determined. That is not a function of a new perspective on history. Let's just take a look at this new perspective. Here's John McCain in 2008. writing, I have also said that any drawdowns must be based on a realistic assessment of conditions on the ground, not an artificial timetable crafted for domestic political reasons. And then, of course, back in 2006, President Bush's speech on Iraq. My decisions on troop levels will be made based on the conditions on the ground, not artificial timetables set by politicians here in Washington, D.C. January 10th of that same year, all of my decisions will be based upon conditions on the ground, not artificial timetables set by Washington politicians. So Donald Trump has rediscovered the wheel for the first time and decided it is rather profound. It goes around.
He said it first on Howard Stern.
Not a square. Not a square. There it is. After great study, he has stumbled upon what every other president has said. And I would say that apparently it didn't work so well last time.
I also believe that he might think he's the first one to think this. I'll give him that one.
Well, I mean, it's probably,
didn't know that.
It's probably not his fault that. Because you've got generals sitting around him all going simultaneously, that's a great idea.
Yeah. That's exactly it.
Well, that is his fault. He's the one that has made it.
That's possibly his fault, yes. What can you do in 15 minutes? Waste time on Facebook or online? Shop for something you don't need? Instead, why not get a summary of a book's main points that you've been meaning to read by listening to the key insights in just 15 minutes? Introducing Blinkist. Blinkist app has over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. Since you're listening to this podcast, you probably love the idea of learning on the go with your smartphone. Imagine if you could listen to the key insights of a nonfiction book in just 15 minutes. With Blinkist, now you can feast your mind on the key ideas from these top-selling nonfiction books, like Why Nations Fail. Spoke to that guy on this program a long time ago.
Very apropos.
Yes, indeed. It is very important. The Myth of a Strong Leader. Crippled America. Two Nations Indivisible. But you can also, there's all sorts. Like you can do the 80-20 principle or the 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. I sometimes listen to that guy's podcast.
Yeah, you like him. A surprising Tim Ferriss fan.
Michael's favorite book, How to Make People Like You in 90 Seconds or Less. If you're just reading, you'll get through maybe one
More
book a week, unless you're Matt Leck, who speeds them up and has some type of thing that I would not recommend for anybody at home. But with the Blinkist app, you can get the key insights from 2 to 3 books on your way home. It gives you more knowledge in less time. Because with Blinkist, you get big ideas in small packages. It will help you be your best by getting better informed. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority right now. Start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. That's Blinkist.com/majority. So Donald Trump has rediscovered the idea of a conditions-based withdrawal, not a timetable. And you know what's great, too, is he didn't even mention what the conditions need to be. So now there's absolutely no way to hold this guy accountable. Wasn't that tricky of me? It's mysterious secret conditions. And of course, I'm so old, I remember when George W. Bush got up in front of the Republican convention, I think it was, in 2000, and said, we will not be a nation building, we will not go on nation building exercises. And Donald Trump must remember that, too, because here is what he said last night. This is clip number 3.
America will continue its support for the Afghan government and the Afghan military as they confront the Taliban in the field. Ultimately, it is up to the people of Afghanistan to take ownership of their future, to govern their society, and to achieve an everlasting peace. We are a partner and a friend, but we will not dictate to the Afghan people how to live or how to govern their own complex society. We are not nation building again. We are killing terrorists.
Okay, so let's put these two things together. I mean, we're a partner and a friend, and I'd also put, like, just in parens, occupying power. I just put that. I mean, most of your partners and friends are like that anyways. And we're not going to leave after a specific amount of time. We're going to leave after a specific conditions of which we will not dictate and will be completely up to the Afghani people, or Afghan people, I should say. And conditions of which are so vague, where apparently the conditions are we're going to kill terrorists. I hope folks see the ridiculousness of this. We're not going to leave until certain conditions are met. We're also not going to impose conditions upon the Afghan people. And to the extent that those conditions are met, you'll never know it because we're never going to say them publicly because we want the element of surprise. Surprise conditions. I don't think that we should have expected anything different. Donald Trump has outsourced the military completely to the military. He has abdicated the commander-in-chief role, which they love to say all the time. And the one instance when he's actually the commander-in-chief, he's basically abdicated. And the idea that you're going to get any people in the media who are going to talk about how sober he was during that speech is just absurd. It's just absurd. But thank God this guy's non-interventionist. I mean, do we have a bet on how long that sort of canard would have lasted anyways?
I think we both said matter of days, if not weeks.
I mean, to be fair.
And we were right. Because he murdered a bunch of Yemenis right out of the gate. So I'm going to go with days.
To the extent that there was any change in policy there, it was, we're probably going to send more troops and we're not going to worry so much about civilian casualties. And that's not even new to the extent that it's been modeled that way in Yemen. And frankly, in Syria.
Afghanistan in some respects. Yep. I mean, he did drop the mother of all bombs there, and they've rewritten rules globally to make it easier to kill civilians. And when he says take the shackles off, I mean, it sounds like they're still trying to refight Vietnam in some ways, right? Because he couldn't win Vietnam because he didn't kill enough people there.
Well, I mean, I don't know that there's the historical context for other people. I think it's just sort of a dynamic that is ever-present. Yeah, maybe. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth Hinton. She's an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Harvard University, and she has written From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. We'll be right back after this.
Shut up, man.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Elizabeth Hinton. She's an assistant professor of history and of African and African American studies at Harvard University and author of The War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
So, all right, let's start with, I guess, when you entered into the research of this book. I mean, did you contemplate the idea that this road to the massive amounts of mass incarceration we have today started in the Johnson administration?
No, I did not. I actually thought the conventional wisdom at the time was that, you know, mass incarceration was kind of the product of policies that were enacted during the Reagan administration. I began this research in the early 2000s, and there were a few scholars who kind of pointed to some of Nixon's policies. And so I kind of began the research with Nixon. I started in the White House Central Files of the Nixon administration, and I quickly discovered that in order to fully put some of his policies in context, I needed to keep on going back. So then I went back to Johnson, and then Johnson eventually led me to the Kennedy administration. So I was very, you know, the origins of modern American law enforcement came from this very unlikely source, which was the Johnson administration. And I, at the time coming into this research, kind of saw Johnson as this great kind of moment of progressive domestic policy with the war on poverty and all of the civil rights legislation the nation witnessed during his presidency. And people hadn't really dealt with at all the extent to which he was really the architect of modern American law enforcement and began and called for, was the first president to call for the federal war on crime.
And so, I mean, how did, explain to us the relationship between, I guess, the war on poverty and the war on crime. And we're talking about, I mean, there's two different things here, right? We're talking about a set of assumptions that undergirds almost both of them in some respects. And then, sort of distinct policies that build off of those set of assumptions. But why don't we start with those set of assumptions and how they manifested through those two different sort of silos of policies?
Right. And so we begin to see these assumptions take hold during the Kennedy administration when federal policymakers recognize, okay, there's been these massive social and demographic changes in American society. There's growing clamor for civil rights. There's a burgeoning civil rights movement. And at the same time, American cities are changing drastically. You have kind of the exodus of many middle-class residents from cities to the suburbs, white and black. And so there remains this kind of growing low-income population of Americans. Cities like Cleveland and Detroit were coming into, were edging a black, at least about half a black population, or at least a third African American. D.C. had come into a black majority. And policymakers said, okay, we've got to address some of these inequalities that are going on in cities to prevent what they and social scientists called the social dynamite, which was kind of shorthand for how they described black youth living in low-income urban communities between the ages of 15 and 24. They recognized that there were certain domestic policies that needed to be implemented in order to prevent unrest in cities or kind of this chaos that they feared given these demographic changes. And they began to understand the kind of root causes of black poverty. And this is very much, you know, informed by social science research from people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was very influential both in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, that, you know, that black pathology and not unemployment, failing housing, failing public schools, was the root cause of poverty. So living in a single-parent household, a kind of culture of poverty, as Moynihan argued, that had been transmitted from one generation to the next. And so the idea was that that this pathological black poverty could be addressed with kind of training programs, with various war on poverty interventions like homemaking programs for single parent mothers, et cetera, that these can be addressed with these training programs, but that in the meantime, the kind of threat of crime, the threat of unrest needed to somehow be managed with new policing programs and new roles for police officers in urban centers. And then as the 60s went on and the social dynamite did indeed explode, first really during the summer of 64 in Harlem and Philadelphia and Rochester, and then of course 65, 66, 67, and then 68, the Johnson administration increasingly entangles many of its war on poverty programs, community action programs, with police programs, and gives police officers and law enforcement authorities kind of greater roles in the social programs that it implemented in cities via the war on poverty.
Okay, so we have this sort of this broad-based of assumption that poverty is a function of culture, and we can reacculturate, I guess, a people, but we need to do so in such a way that they are have it basically like the equivalent of like a safe learning environment. Therefore, we have to separate. I mean, I'm just putting this in context because there is a sort of equality to this, but I'm putting it in the context of like, you know, controversy that'll come up with my kids in preschool. You know, we have to take the kids who are a problem and make sure that we're addressing them. Maybe we got to put a paraprofessional on them or whatever it is. That is sort of the dynamic that's going on here. Let me, before we go further and sort of see how that plays out, What was the theory, that culture theory, which, you know, we can see echoes of even, I mean, as recent as President Obama, frankly. But
before we get there,
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. What were the rival theories to that? Or were there any rival theories to what Moynihan was promoting?
Well, I mean, there was quite a bit, even, you know, I mean, so much of the policies in the 1960s were in response to civil rights and unrest. And even within the mainstream civil rights movement, especially after the enactment of the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, there were greater calls for socioeconomic inclusion, socioeconomic transformation. Even Johnson's Kerner Commission, which he calls after the unrest in Detroit and Newark in 67, says we need a Marshall Plan for American cities. So there is kind of a set of fighting pathology, or, you know, providing people with job training programs without a job creation program isn't going to solve the root causes of so much of this unrest and inequality. So there is, and I mean, you know, through the Reagan administration, even policymakers say consistently, we know that so much of the causes of crime and violence is rooted in unemployment and, you know, these public schools lacking fundamental resources. But that's a long-term fight. And in the short term, we have to deal with the impending crime threat. So we need to get more police on the streets. So there's always, I mean, within the kind of political protests, greater calls for socioeconomic inclusion that policymakers on a whole really, really resist, and that I think that, you know, are still very much resisted today.
So so if I understand you correctly, there were good answers out there, but I mean, was there a different perspective than the cultural thing? I mean, is that reflected in the Kerner? Maybe a good way to address this is to tell us about the Kerner Commission and contrast it with the Crime Commission.
So, in addition to even, you know, I mean, so just thinking civil rights, the mainstream civil rights movement, you know, Martin Luther King is really kind of looking at economic exploitation and exclusion and we remember, you know, the March on Washington was the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. So I think, and in interviews that policymakers and social scientists did with those who had participated in much of the unrest or riots in the 1960s, people consistently said, you know, the proximate cause of this incident might have been police brutality, but really the larger issue is that, you know, we are living in an economically an increasingly isolated community amid growing deindustrialization, and we really need jobs if we're going to solve this unrest. So there is this kind of political thrust within mainstream civil rights for major socioeconomic reform. The Kerner Commission, you know, similarly recognized this based on the field work that many of its members and its staff did in communities that had suffered from unrest or that resembled other communities that experienced unrest, and said, okay, if we want to, you know, really prevent these types of incidents and this violence and the burning from happening every single summer, from being kind of a common occurrence in American life, we have to fundamentally contribute and dedicate resources to improving the basic infrastructure of low-income urban communities to address the kind of historical inequalities that had defined U.S. social relations, and to actually give people equal outcomes and equal opportunities to get jobs, to be able to provide to their families, to be able to feed their kids healthy meals every night. So the Kerner and Johnson himself, when the Kerner Commission report came out, and I think it's most kind of famous for, you know, its opening line, our nation is moving in, you know, in two different societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal, really indicting American racism for so much of the kind of social discord of the 1960s. The Johnson administration, you know, completely distanced itself from the report, and Johnson himself refused to comment on any of the Kerner Commission's conclusions because they were seen as too radical. You know, for him and for his Council of Economic Advisors, who really devised the War on Poverty, because they assumed that, okay, the root cause of poverty is pathological, they thought that, you know, they could fight, even though the War on Poverty marked the unprecedented investment in low-income people and improving their daily lives, they thought that poverty could be fought relatively cheaply without major job creation programs, because for them, the source was not these socioeconomic inequalities, but kind of pathological behavior that they hoped that many of the programs of the War on Poverty would, quote-unquote, fix.
So, I mean, did those ideas that it was simply a pathology, were they just simply rooted in the fact that pre-war and during the World War II and prior to World War II in the Jim Crow era and prior to that, I mean, was that just simply a continuum of a sort of a racist perspective, or was there some type of like, oh, we found new research that, that popularized this myth or what? I mean, was that just simply a continuation on the way that white America viewed black America?
Right. I mean, I think that, that comment kind of like brings together the answer beautifully, which is, you know, that these assumptions are very much rooted in policymakers' own racism about black cultural pathology and black culture and these ideas, these tropes within American history about black laziness, black criminality, and a real kind of, you know, the idea that somehow black poverty is the, you know, result of black people's own behavior and own personal choices and family choices and family dynamics rather than centuries of exploitation and structural exclusion. And the theories that began to rise, and I think, you know, Moynihan is kind of the person that had the ear of many of these presidential administrations, worked in the Johnson and Kennedy administration, worked as one of Nixon's domestic advisors, that, you know, that this theory begins to kind of take off and eventually explains much of the, is used as an explanation to explain how we get moments such as, you know, Watts in 1965 and Detroit in 1967 and the series of uprisings that occur following the assassination of Martin Luther King in the spring of 68. So, you know, his theory is partly embraced because of even the most liberal policymakers' assumptions and blind spots when it comes to the kind of impact of racism and ideas about black Americans.
And I would just add, I mean, just because we're going to be running this interview next, a different interview next week with Richard Rothstein about how housing policy in the decades preceding the ones that you're talking about, basically created, when we talk about strife in urban cities, is because there was a tremendous amount of push to get people out into the suburbs. And when I say people, I mean only white people. And in fact, black people were prevented essentially from moving through our housing policy. And we'll, like I say, we'll talk about that next week. But I hope, you know, I just want to make it clear that this is part of a continuum, and the problems that they are dealing with at that time are, in many respects, a direct result of policies that preceded it by a decade or two, coming out of social, coming out of the New Deal. All right, so with that basic assumption, then that there is a cultural problem amongst people of color, black people, and we're going to have sort of benign responses to that, and then we're going to have another track of, like, we're also got to take the bad element, you know, where I guess, like, these pathologies cross along the spectrum of pathology into being, irredeemable, and that's how we create the carceral. What are the policies that build that?
Right. So, I mean, so essentially, you know, with, and just to be clear, you know, Johnson calls the war on crime in March 65, he sends the first piece of federal legislation, which begins an assistance program to state and local law enforcement, a week before he sends the Voting Rights Act, and a week after he sent the Housing and Urban Development Act, which subsidized private homes to low-income renters to the percent, a very important piece of domestic legislation. So this is kind of, you know, the war on poverty and the war on crime within the Great Society kind of function as a carrot and a stick, offering to low-income people and to people of color and Black Americans in particular. The pathological ideas about Black poverty and Black families eventually kind of lead policymakers to say, okay, we need to, and this is in the book, I talk a lot about much of the crime policies being preemptive. Eventually, young children living in segregated urban communities are all seen as kind of potentially criminal, and the idea is that certain interventions, both in the Johnson administration at least, both social welfare interventions and punitive interventions, can prevent these potential criminals or potential delinquents from actually resorting to crime. So the whole thing is based on this idea, like, okay, there's this prospect of urban rebellion, there's this prospect of unrest, there's a prospect for crime, and if we can kind of put police officers in those communities, bring more police officers on the streets, and, you know, launch some kind of a social welfare intervention, we can prevent these potential delinquents from actually resorting to delinquency. And again, you know, this idea of potential delinquency in groups of, within groups of American citizens, in this case, Black youth between the ages, and specifically actually Black men between the ages, or young men between the ages of 15 and 24, if crime can be, you know, this is a potentially delinquent group, and if we get them at the right at an early stage, we can prevent them from eventually resorting to more serious crime. So what this does is essentially labels a generation and then generations of Black youth as criminal based on these pathological assumptions stemming from many of the same ideas that inform policymakers thinking about Black poverty, labels them criminal before they had actually committed a crime. And accordingly begins a new set of police programs that give police officers new roles in urban social institutions, new roles in after school programs, new roles in on school grounds themselves, new patrol programs within public housing projects. And so police become a kind of a more ubiquitous part of everyday life for not just the potentially delinquent youth, but also their entire communities and their families. And in the process, these communities become criminalized.
So the idea is that we're going to catch them when they're budding criminals. And if we get them young enough and put them into the penal system in some fashion, then they will basically, I mean, I guess there's a lot of faith, too, I guess, in this early penal system that it will in some way rehabilitate or course correct. Right. And just put and put these potential criminals back onto the spectrum of just being culturally deficient. I guess. Right. I mean,
and the idea is that police contact is kind of key to preventing future crime, and that punishment serves as a powerful deterrent to crime. Both of these theories have since, especially the idea that punishment functions as a viable crime deterrent, have been proven false, but they really guided much of the logic during the development of the kind of modern American carceral state in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s.
How do you articulate that the difference in perspective between intervention sort of temporally in the lives of individuals versus intervention in the broader context in which these like broad societal phenomenon happen?
So you mean the ways in which how programs respond to kind of individual dynamics versus the larger,
I guess, as an academic, I'm just curious as to how do you contrast those two perspectives, right? Because in one perspective, it's just the idea is like there's a cultural problem amongst this group of people. And so if we, get to them when they're, you know, 3 or 7 or 10 years old, and maybe, you know, and we scare them straight on some level, we can be helpful, as opposed to we have a group of people who are living in the context of, you know, where it permeates the entire sort of society or segment of society, where there's no opportunity. There are these broad realities where, instead of intervening in that context, we're just going to intervene in the individual lives and try and fix each individual in this way.
Right. I mean, I think part of it has to do with shifting domestic policies in response to this phenomena that policymakers and researchers are observing on the ground. So, increasingly, and this begins to happen even during the Johnson administration, especially in the context of, you know, urban uprising happening and escalating during every summer of his presidency, this kind of moves policymakers more and more from ideas that social welfare interventions will prevent crime, and eventually, police officers and law enforcement programs become a more important investment on the part of policymakers and usurp in many respects social welfare programs. We really begin to see this change during the Nixon administration, when the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance that Johnson starts in 1965, 1 year after the Office of Economic Opportunity becomes implemented as a major administration through the Department of Justice. We never saw that kind of support and the Office of Economic Opportunity evolve into a major administrative agency within, at that time, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And increasingly, the programs of the Office of Economic Opportunity are administered by the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the Department of Justice. And so what were once kind of framed as social welfare programs, like job training programs and, things like internships for potentially delinquent youth, become crime prevention programs that are run by the Department of Justice. So I think part of it is that this individual pathological response that is initially seen as something that can be addressed through social welfare, war on poverty interventions, increasingly becomes seen as something that is innately criminal, that can only be addressed through crime control interventions that are funded by the Department of Justice.
Was that in part a function of just trying to sell these policies? Right? I mean, it just seems like, you know, you could sell them as we're going to better the lives of these individuals, or we're going to cut down on crime. And theoretically, I guess the policies could be the same.
They were the same during the Kennedy administration, and the kind of origins of this, where many of the programs that eventually become implemented as the war on poverty are initially created as part of President Kennedy's national anti-delinquency program. So, I mean, part of it is how do we approach controlling crime? Do we control crime through more surveillance and more police and more incarceration, or do we control crime potential crime by giving people jobs and by improving conditions in public schools. Either approach could be seen as a crime prevention approach, and I think throughout most of the 60s, they're both tried. By the time we get to the Nixon administration, especially as crime and this in some respects has to do with crime reporting that is a product of the modernization effort of American crime control, eventually crime escalates, crime rates escalate, and policymakers say, okay, well, this is an innate problem, and these social welfare programs haven't worked to stop crime, so we need to abandon them and just kind of increasingly embrace a more punitive response to social problems facing low-income urban Americans.
Can you track this? Is it possible to track this evolution or devolution in terms of expenditures by the government? And if you can, is it worthwhile to do that or what?
So that's part of what I did in the book. And I think in some ways get to that question of kind of the interplay between individual and structural and how these ideas actually materialize. And so if we really look at, you know, not only what are the agencies that that the White House and Congress, various administrations are supporting, if we look at kind of the ways in which funding for crime control and funding for prisons balloons over the course of the 1970s, whereas, you know, that policymakers are divesting in many respects from education and community action programs and funding for grassroots organizations, we really see, I mean, that was kind of part of their approach, follow the money. Where are federal grants actually going, and how, through block grant funding, which is the way that the National Crime Control Program is implemented, how are policymakers shaping state and local priorities? How are federal policymakers shaping these priorities by the ways in which they are making grant funding available and stipulating that states spend funding on law enforcement and criminal justice?
And so where are we today in this? I mean, because, you know, I the only thing that keeps sort of resonating in my head is President Obama's My Brother's Keeper program, I think it was called, which seems to me to be, I mean, sort of still adopting that same sort of perspective that this is that we're looking at like a cultural problem. I mean, this remains fairly consistent throughout. I mean, doesn't it throughout 80s, 90s to now?
Yes. I mean, we don't even during the Reagan administration, you know, there's not much talk about, there's a lot of talk about cultural pathology, but there's not much funding for social welfare programs. And actually that's when we really begin to see kind of massive disinvestment from spending on social welfare and public assistance. But certainly, I mean, I think these ideas about Black cultural pathology have kind of shaped the American imagination since its founding, and it's much easier, and as policymakers themselves admitted, in the kind of like short term, it's easier to kind of blame the victim than it is to really kind of come to terms with historical racism and economic inequality in our society, to say, okay, it's actually, you know, if we want to solve these problems of inequality and poverty, then it's the personal, this is Obama's language, kind of Black Americans' own personal responsibility to solve that. But that doesn't recognize, as you mentioned, you know, the kind of systemic exclusion that, I mean, even just within the post-war period, we begin to see with housing and who has access to housing and who has access to benefits and the GI Bill. So until we really come to terms with these kind of larger structural transformations in American history, the inequalities that we see and kind of this consistent embrace of punitive responses to social problems will kind of continue to steer much of our domestic policy. One of the things that the book, I think, really demonstrates is that this approach to socioeconomic inequality and exclusion, dealing with that with police and surveillance programs and locking people up, has not worked to alleviate fundamental inequalities and disadvantage in our society. And so it's very discouraging to see that the Trump administration is kind of going back and embracing these more draconian, hard-nosed policies that law enforcement officials themselves, many of them, recognize now as complete failures. They haven't effectively controlled crime and violence in certain communities, and we now have this major problem of mass incarceration that's a further drain on state resources. So I think part of it is we've really got to embrace a different kind of thinking about prevention that goes beyond pathology, that goes beyond personal responsibility, and that begins to think about how we can redistribute basic resources and begin to make that kind of investment, that kind of Marshall Plan the Kerner Commission suggested, in low-income areas, and maybe not just in urban centers, but also in rural areas where there exists extreme disadvantage and marginalization as well.
All right, so one last question on this, because I'm just curious if this is if there's a trap here. Because on one level, as you're saying that, it occurs to me that, you know, let's put aside Trump for a moment to the extent that we can not have him in the forefront of our minds. But there was a budding, nascent movement that was trans-ideological, if you will, to reform our penal system, right? I mean, there was conservatives.
Yeah.
And if addressing it from that perspective, that the problem is the carceral state, if that isn't falling into that same trap, or does both have to happen simultaneously? One, we have...
I think both...
All right, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Please lay it out.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that you understood my question was just that, you know, if we address the carceral state as the problem, as opposed to the carceral state is an outgrowth and a function of another sociological, economic problem that we have. Are we falling into that same trap again, or do we?
Right.
Go ahead.
So that's part of what is, you know, the fiscal arguments about that really have led to, you know, some of the like right on crime, Newt Gingrich and the Koch brothers kind of embracing people who are on the right embracing this criminal justice reform moment only because it is not sustainable for states. I mean, the root cause of so much of this has to do with racism and has to do with, so it's in part really coming to terms with the ways that racism after the civil rights movement and kind of the rise of incarceration and policing programs and, you know, our kind of changes in sentencing and this real punitive turn in domestic policies, how that is not just rooted in, is very much rooted in racism inequality that has really defined this nation historically. So partly it's coming in terms with that, but also the real problems that we're facing in terms of unemployment and lack of real opportunities for mobility for low-income Americans across the country, not just in urban centers, you know, everywhere. So part of it is dealing with the impacts of the decline of domestic manufacturing and the transition to a skilled and service economy. And the other is really dealing with racism and the ways in which consistently incarceration and policing programs become a kind of solution to new racial orders first that emerged. You know, we begin to see the rise of the convict leasing system, et cetera, after emancipation and then following civil rights, we get this new modernized law enforcement where police officers are taking on new roles in urban centers. So until we deal with racism and inequality in this country and the kind of historic undercurrents of that, reforming criminal justice is not going to be enough to really lessen inequality in America.
Elizabeth Hinton, the book is From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, this program relies on your membership. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also support this program by buying all of your coffee needs from a fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate outlet known as justcoffee.coop. C-O-O-P. We have a great transition. We have a great transition song into the fun half today. Also, a reminder, if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. We get pennies on the purchase, but if there's enough of you that buy, those pennies add up, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll also tell you that next week, among the interviews we'll have is an interview with Richard Rothstein, who has written about the sort of the era that preceded the one that Elizabeth Hinton is writing about, where a lot of the dynamics were very consciously set up. I mean, yeah, the level of consciousness is as to what would come from it. I don't know if it was there, but certainly it'll be a fascinating interview to sort of see what precedes this era when the war on poverty sort of merged with the war on crime. So make sure you check that out. All right, here is, who did this one again?
This is by Theo Dillon.
Theo Dillon. And somehow we missed this the first time, but this is pretty awesome stuff. This is, as you know, a lot of our listeners have been sending in fun half ditties. I'm not even sure how that started, but it's been great. And this is the latest one. This one is really terrific. And then we will head into La Poupée and head into the fun half. And don't forget, you could be part of the fun half if you join the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, oh, don't forget, tonight, Trademark BS or Too Much Michael Brooks? Too Much Brooks show is live
Richard's
tonight.
Richard's best line ever.
I like that one. Too Much Brooks show is live tonight at 7 p.m. on our YouTube channel. That is youtube.com/Sam Cedar. That is the Majority Report channel.
And may I just thank the first 561 patrons and the first 86 reviews on iTunes and Noah Changa and Sam Sachs tonight.
Noah Changa and Sam Sachs tonight. And of course, Too Much Brooks.
And of course, me. Too Much Me.
All right. Here is the, that's 7 p.m. And here is the little ditty.
Oh, wait. Do we have that new fun half song? This is apparently what the kids are doing today. Still, apparently, the kids are doing today. What the kids are doing today. Apparently, back when I was a kid, right? That's where it's all going, apparently. Like, kids work. That's where it's all going, apparently. Like, kids are doing hip hop. And youth kids are incredibly offensive. Youth kids, right? That's hip hop. And youth or hip hop. And youth or right? That's hip hop. And youth or DM. That's where it's all going, apparently. Youth or DM.
Oh, is that awesome? All right, see you in the fun
that
half.
That's impressive. There's some of these are really good.
Sad. She said things are looking bad.